John Hastings Turner. I've got to put this thing on paper. I've told the story again and again, and I find at the finish of it that even my best friends are trying not to look slantwise at me. I don't blame them. It is, as one of them said to me, a hell of a proposition. But the way I feel is that if once I can get the thing down in black and white, it won't, so to speak, be on my mind so much. It was after I had told Bill Whiteman the story, and asked him the question I always ask, that I got the answer which I have written. A hell of a proposition it may be. And perhaps I too ought to be where poor Robbie McLaren is, and he's been in an asylum these 2 years. I'd known Robbie since the days when we knocked cricket balls through his father's cucumber frames and then told lies about it. For Robbie's father was about 60 years out of date, and Robbie feared him more than he feared hell. I think if his mother had lived, or if his father had been another kind of man, Robbie might have been every bit as sane as the rest of us. But he was hunted, literally hunted, through his boyhood. But that has nothing to do with the story. He became an architect. He never did much at it. I believe his ideas were a bit impracticable. And anyway, he wasn't long enough at the job to make his mark. He was 28 when the thing happened, and I was 2 years his senior. Of course, I knew that Robbie was what people call peculiar. That is to say, he didn't fall in line with everybody else. He didn't play games, or shoot, or dance. In fact, the only thing he did do was to play the piano. His own stuff. And for all I know, abominable. But I liked to hear him play for all that. I had a little flat in Charing Cross Road, and one evening in the early summer, Robbie blew in. I hadn't seen him for months. And I thought he looked rather used up. "Look here, Roger," he said. "I want some air." "You won't get it in Charing Cross Road," I answered. "I want to go for a week walking." "Anywhere," he went on. "Will you come?" It was an attractive idea. The weather seemed set fair. The country would be at its best. I said I might. "When I say anywhere," he continued, "I mean the Savernake Forest." "Why?" I asked. "I'm not going at all if I don't go there," he replied. Well, I ought to have thought that a bit queer, I dare say, but I didn't. Robbie had always been a creature of whims, and if he'd set his heart on the Savernake Forest, why not? It's a lovely spot. I said I didn't care where we went, and after a bit of talk and planning things out, we agreed to make a start the following Saturday. For a miracle, the weather held, and as we walked out of Wantage, our faces set towards the Downs, I think we both felt about 18. I can answer for myself, at least. And Robbie's high spirits were almost embarrassing. He chucked his hat away over a hedge and sang lewd songs at the top of his voice. But Robbie had always hated towns and became a different creature in the country. We tramped along for a couple of days, taking things easily. And I must confess, I never remember such a grand time. The air was intoxicating. The turf like walking on a springboard, and a subtle, satisfying appeal was coming to us from the very earth. the appeal of being English in England. Robbie was Scotch, but he swore he felt it too. Those first 2 days were pure joy. On the third, we were in the forest itself, surprising squirrels and rabbits, and once in the evening, an old badger. We deviated that night and slept at the smallest inn we have ever seen, in a village of which we didn't even ask the name, and in the charming, contemptuous English way, the name not being written up for us anywhere. I do not know it to this day. On the following morning, we struck back into the forest, and then I noticed that Robbie was beginning to hurry. He set about twice the pace we had been travelling. When I taxed him with it, he slowed down and made some silly joke about my getting an old man. But I noticed that he seemed curiously embarrassed. A strange eagerness seemed to have got hold of him. It was as if, yes, almost as if he was pointing, like a dog. But at the time, though I noticed his mood, I gave it no serious thought. Why should I? It was so like Robbie to have some unaccountable enthusiasm. We lunched under a beech tree, and I remember a green woodpecker, shyest of birds, came and looked at us gravely from across the riding, and, deciding that we were harmless, if unusual, continued his tap-tapping without taking any further notice. When we had religiously buried our empty beer bottles and were watching the smoke from our pipes go spiring up into the leaves, I said casually, "Where do we turn in tonight, Robbie?" "Oh, I know a place," he answered. And I noticed, or thought I noticed, a queer constraint in his voice, as if he was facing a crisis of some sort, a crisis which he knew would come. But I was sleepy and paid no heed to it. "Well, anyway," I murmured, "don't let's overshoot the mark again and have an extra 2 miles to the village at the end of the day." For that was what we had done before, and 2 unexpected miles, just when you're wanting your supper, seem a day's journey. Robbie's voice became suddenly quite surly. "It isn't a village," he said abruptly. "Oh, look here, Robbie," I protested. "If you think I'm going to doss down in some broken-down woodman's shack and go without my dinner, you're on the wrong horse." He struck a match to relight his pipe, and his hand trembled ever so little. "It's not a shack," he said. "That's anything but a shack." He seemed to be trying to control some intense excitement. He gave me the impression that he was angry with me for asking questions. But I wasn't going to stand that. It isn't good for a chap, even if he does have moods and whims, to be given in to all the time. I said, "Well, you needn't be so mysterious about it." He didn't answer for a moment or two, and when he did, he had his back turned to me. "It's a house," he muttered. "A house?" I echoed. "What? Here in the middle of the forest, miles from anywhere?" "Yes," he said. He seemed to hate to talk about it. "But it's impossible," I cried. He turned then, and I saw that he was furiously angry. "It isn't impossible," he retorted. "I tell you, I know the house, and I know the people who live there." "I know the house. Well," he added in a gentler tone, as if he was remembering tenderly something happy about the place. "Oh, all right," I answered, "but you never said anything about it before." "Why should I?" he snapped, and I had no reply to that. "I can't think how they carry on," I said, "marooned like that. Why, they'd never get a servant to stay in the place." He seemed to turn that over in his mind for a few seconds. Then he said, with a sort of gentle, reminiscent smile, "Oh, they're all family servants. They've been there for years." "All the same," I protested, "they may not be exactly pleased at two fellows blowing in without notice, both as hungry as hell." "They'll be delighted," he said earnestly. Delighted. Didn't I tell you I'd known them for years? Oh, well, I answered, it's up to you. After which we took the road again, or rather the path, for the riding had narrowed down to a bridle track, and the woods were thick all round us. I couldn't help wondering what strange sort of birds elected to live in the middle of a forest, and, with my practical everyday sort of mind, speculating on how they ran the place. And from that I got to wondering how on earth the house came to be built, for you can't, as far as I know, buy a plot in the middle of Savernack Forest. I even came to the point where I was considering the possibility of Robbie trying to play a practical joke on me. And by this time, feeling a bit leggy, I thought what a rotten sort of joke it would be, and promised myself a real row with Robbie when he exploded it. Meanwhile, Robbie himself was going faster and faster. Hang it, he was racing along as if he were on the Stock Exchange walk. And his face, it was purple with excitement, and his eyes were glittering like a panther on the trail. I thought, damn, he's been sitting on wet grass, and he's got a chill, and he's feverish. And I wondered what on earth I'd do about it, for Robbie was not strong, and if he was going to be ill, he'd have complications quicker than anybody on earth. But just as I was speculating on these lines, we turned a corner abruptly and came upon the house. I must confess, I was relieved to see that house. If Robbie had taken a chill, we could at least get a hot water bottle and a whiskey and lemon for him. And I took another sidelong look at the man. I was astonished at the change in him. The mere sight of the house seemed to have returned him to the normal. He stood quite still, looking at it with a sort of appreciative smile. "Well, here we are," I said at last. "Damn it, Robbie, you've almost walked me off my feet." "Sorry," he replied. "You see, I got in a funk that I shouldn't be able to find it." So that was it. But fancy working oneself up into such a state. Thank God I had an ordinary workaday temperament that refused to fatigue itself. Then, for the first time, I took a real look at the house itself. It was a new house, and that gave me a bit of a shock, because for some absurd reason or other I had expected an old one. But this was quite new. So new indeed that the polygonum they meant to train up its walls was merely a row of spindly branches, and in the freshly laid lawn one could still see the gaps between the turfs. As for the house itself, it was pleasing enough to look upon, built on two floors, with green shutters to the windows, which somehow or other gave it a foreign appearance. And yet, though it was an ordinary enough kind of house at first sight, there was something about it. Some oddity which struck one, as such things will, even before one had time to see exactly what it was. But in another second, as we were approaching the front door, I saw what made the place look unusual. The roof, from each end of the long, low house, it rose with a gentle slope to a point in the centre. I'd never seen a roof built like that. And now that I did, I couldn't help feeling that, with a long, low house like that, the effect of that slight slope in the centre angle where it met was rather pleasing. I said as much to Robbie. "Curious kind of roof," I commented, "but in a way rather effective, don't you think?" "Do you?" he said with a curious eagerness. "Yes, I agree. I like it immensely. Immensely." I thought his sudden enthusiasm rather odd, until I remembered that he was an architect, and that these things meant a great deal more to him than they did to me. He rang the bell, and in the interval before the door was opened, I noticed that it was as much as he could do to keep still. A maid opened the door and recognised him immediately. "Mr. McLaren," she said, and smiled at us. Then she added, "I'll go and tell the master at once." And Robbie stopped her "I'm Miss Dorothy," he said. "She's at home, isn't she?"
"Oh, yes, sir,"
answered the maid.
"Miss Dorothy is at home."
I thought then that I understood everything. Robbie's excitement, his embarrassment, for that, of course, was the explanation of his bad temper. Everything. But why on earth couldn't he have told me about Dorothy? After all, we had been friends for years. I was congratulating myself on such a simple explanation of what I had foolishly thought to be a feverish attack when I saw an old gentleman coming down the stairs to meet us. When I say old, I mean that he was what men of our age call old. I dare say he was round about 60, and one of the most charming-looking men I've ever seen. His expression of welcome to us both, not only in his words, but his face, made one feel in an instant that in that house one could never be a stranger again. His arm went round Robbie's shoulder, but he smiled at both of us as he said,
"Now, what would you two boys like? A drink right away, or a wash first? And join Dorothy and myself for cocktails in a quarter of an hour?"
We chose the latter, and were shown to our rooms. Our host insisted on coming with us himself. I remember when he left us, feeling what a pity Robbie's father hadn't been that kind of man. He radiated everything that was generous, everything that was lovable, and evidently he was used to entertaining. My room looked as if I had been expected at this very moment. Robbie came in to me after a wash and brush up, and I commented on the readiness of things. I remember he walked to the window and sighed, a deep, contented sort of sigh, and then he turned and said quite simply, "But you are, Roger. I've always been expected here." We went downstairs, and Dorothy gave us cocktails. She was a lovely girl, with a sly sense of fun that made one feel there was no barrier between the sexes after all. I'd begun to look on myself as a confirmed bachelor, because I believed that, in the really intimate concerns of life, it is impossible to get on terms with a woman. But if you could, I mean if her mind really marches with your own. Well, I must admit that after my second glass of port, I regarded Robbie as an undeserving young devil. And then those two disappeared somewhere or other, and Dorothy's father smiled at me and produced some old brandy and said it was good to look at them, wasn't it? And I said it was, and I felt it too. But there was something about that house and its occupants that somehow made you see life properly. And then Dorothy's father asked if I would like to see over the place, and of course I said yes. And he showed me every hole and corner in a way that made me know he loved it. And later Robbie and Dorothy joined us, and Robbie enthused over the place as if it were his own, which, I reflected, it might well be one day. And, may as well confess the thing, I was a little jealous of Robbie. I remember thinking, just before I dropped off to sleep that night, that it was rather a rotten sort of feeling to have had. And the next day, off we went again. I tried to rag Robbie in the silly way men do about Dorothy, but he got savage about it, and I shut up. We walked in silence for some time, and I had leisure in which to think that it isn't really such a grand joke. People falling in love, I mean. Nobody sees anything tremendously funny about Primavera or Eloise and Abelard. What blasted cads we make of ourselves, following silly conventions. I remember I tried to apologize to Robbie, and he said, "That's all right," and said it too as if it didn't matter a damn what I'd said, because I suppose I was too small to count in the world he was living in just then. And I thought how right he was. And I felt a bit humble. And, as a sort of punishment, I put up with the long, silent walk that followed. I asked no more questions, and I certainly made no more silly jokes. We found our way to another country inn, and had the simple dinner they provided. And it was there that it happened. Suddenly, straight out of the blue, in that shabby little coffee room, Robbie gave a queer cry and burst into tears. I got him up to his room, somehow or other. I can still see the shocked and deprecating eye of a local farmer who had dined there too. In the bedroom, Robbie went mad. What I mean is, I believe that it was there his brain actually snapped. He did incredible things. He said incredible things. I'm not going to set them down here. I locked the door, found the landlord, and got him to send someone for the local doctor. By the grace of God, he was a man who knew more than he had need of in that little place. When I took him into Robbie's room, Robbie was stretched full length on his bed, naked, with the tears streaming down his face. I can't remember very much about what happened in that room. The doctor asked Robbie a question or two, and I remember him turning up his eyelids. Then he drew the coverlet over Robbie's stark, twitching body, and he and I went outside.
"I'm going to ring for an ambulance," he said, "and your friend will be taken to London."
"What's happened to him?" I asked.
"I can't tell you that," answered the doctor. "I wish I could. If I could, I'd be one of the world's greatest men. But I'm afraid I can tell you his condition. He's insane, poor chap. I may be wrong, but I think he's been insane for a considerable time. Something has brought it to a head, that's all."
And so they took Robbie to London, where certain formalities were gone through. And Robbie disappeared to the place where now he is. But I, being his friend, though I felt helpless, yet imagined it was at least my duty to tell the old man in the house with the strange roof, and to ask him as gently as he could to tell his daughter Dorothy. Perhaps you can guess what happened. There was no house in the wood. There was no charming old gentleman. There was no Dorothy. They told me that at the inn, but I wasn't satisfied, and I went back myself to the very spot. There were trees and a little winding path, through little bushes struggling towards the sun. There was no place where a house could ever have been, and yet, I've got to confess it, I can still see that charming host. I can still see Dorothy disappearing with Robbie into the newly made garden. I can still tell you every hole and corner of the house which the old man so lovingly showed me. I can even see the old quart cupboard out of which he brought the decanter of liqueur brandy. Yet I'm allowed to go about my business, while poor Robbie... Oh. Still, they tell me he's perfectly happy. They say he spends most of his time drawing plans for grandiose and impossible palaces. Well, I've written the thing down now. Although it's probably not particularly interesting, it has given me a certain amount of comfort in the doing. And if I am going mad, somebody will know why. I shall just put this MS in my desk, and it will be found afterwards. I wrote this yesterday, with an idea in my head that I wouldn't cumber the earth with my presence much longer. Yes, I'd even taken the old service revolver out of the drawer and had a look at it. But, thank God. Thank God. I'm sane. They found a note at Robbie's office, saying that if anything happened to him, I was the only friend he had, and he would like me to go through his papers. I spent an afternoon carrying out Robbie's wish. And all of a sudden, I came across a careful and minute plan of the house in Savernake Forest. A queer roof, everything. I recognized every room, every corner, and just underneath it, on a sheet of notepaper, I found a poem. It was written to Dorothy. And though no power on earth would make me write it down here, I can say that it described the Dorothy I knew beautifully and completely. And then suddenly, I knew. This was Robbie's ideal house, Robbie's ideal father, Robbie's ideal girl. He had created them all for himself. He had lived with them, dreamt with them. And then, alone with me in the forest, his brain, so much more vivid than my own, had made the thing real to me, too. That's all. But perhaps you'd like to know the question I always put when I tell this story. Do you think, I ask, that it is possible for an hallucination, which is a real and vivid thing to a lunatic, to be so impressed upon the mind of another chap that it materializes, at least for the time being? When I asked Bill Whiteman that, he just said, "It's a hell of a proposition." I suppose it is. But I've no doubts whatever myself. Today's story was The House in the Wood by John Hastings Turner. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. Well, I do hope you enjoyed it. And till next time, sweet dreams.